With us now is British historian Miranda Vickers. She has written extensively on the Albanian people. Her latest book is Between Serb and Albanian, A History of Kosovo. Vickers just returned this week from Kosovo, Albania, and Montenegro, where she was working as the Albanian analyst for the International Crisis Group, an organization which was set up after the Dayton Accord. I asked her what effects she saw from the fighting.
Well, I've been visiting quite frequently since the outbreak of the present crisis in March this year after the Drenica massacre. And I've noticed, as far as the Albanians are concerned, a distinct change in mood. After Drenica, the Albanian population of Kosovo was pretty sure that the international community would intervene on their behalf in some way or another fairly quickly, whereas the Serbs felt they felt the international community had no right to intervene on their behalf. And so the two communities have viewed this so diametrically in opposite stances. The Albanians have become very disillusioned because there hasn't been any international intervention on their behalf. And the Serbs are quietly feeling that the international community is actually backing them in some way by allowing Milosevic to pursue his attacks on Albanian villages.
There have been reports from people like, or organizations like, Doctors Without Borders that there are many refugees now, many of them fleeing for the hills, and that their condition is really quite critical. What did you observe?
Well, yes, I found bedraggled groups of Albanian families with what livestock they could actually rescue from their smashed villages and heading for the hills where they have a certain amount of food available, but they have very little water, and several babies have been born up there. The conditions are frightfully inadequate for newborn children and for the elderly, but at least the temperatures are so warm that people can sleep out at night at the moment without risking dying, but in about 2 months' time, the temperature will dramatically change and we'll get the beginning of the horrendous Balkan winters, which are absolutely ferocious, where the snow settles in that region for 3 to 4 months, and then an enormous thaw occurs in which the area is completely engulfed by mud. So we do have a potential humanitarian crisis if this situation isn't resolved before winter and these people are allowed back to their homes.
If these refugees then went back to their villages, what would they find?
Well, we don't see in Kosovo the mass destruction that we saw in Bosnia, where whole villages were completely annihilated and razed to the ground. What we're seeing is several houses being torched. As a sort of example, the Serbs are in a very vitriolic mood when they take over these villages, and this is one way that they show their domination. But they have been trying to encourage Albanians to return. A few have managed to return, but those that do are asked to report to police stations immediately. Now, this is the concern that the international community has about what happens in these police cells, because the women and children are separated from the men. The men go to the police stations and several of them are returned back home beaten up, severely beaten up. Now, this is no way to encourage people to return to their homes.
Is this an organized campaign, or do you think this is a disorganized campaign, on one hand encouraging people to come home and on the other hand threatening them or beating them when they do?
Well, it's very hard to imagine the logic behind it, because it's hard to understand the logic in going to the effort of encouraging Albanians to come home to their villages, which is what the international community are asking the Yugoslav authorities to do. And then on the other hand, making it virtually impossible for them to be guaranteed a secure, safe passage once they get there.
Do you know how many refugees there are? Because the numbers go from 100,000 to something like 230,000.
Well, the latest estimates from the United Nations refugee organizations are 167,000 registered refugees in Albania and Montenegro, as well as Kosovo.
When you speak to refugees, whether Albanian or Serbian, who do they blame? Who do they hold responsible for the condition of their republic?
The Albanians blame equally the regime of Slobodan Milosevic, but also the international community for allowing their plight to be ignored for the last 6 to 7 years. When the Yugoslav state broke up, there were numerous conferences on the future of status of Croatia, Slovenia, Bosnia, but no mention at all of Kosovo. Kosovo was ignored at the London conference in 1992 on the former Yugoslavia, and also again at the Dayton Agreement, Kosovo was not mentioned. And therefore the Albanians put the blame fair and squarely on the international community for not having brought Milosevic into line and helped them in their cause for self-determination. The Serbs, on the other hand, blame the Albanians and also the Albanian government, which is quite mistaken, for agitating, helping the Kosovars to agitate and amass arms, which they say the Albanian government and army allowed them to take from Albania following the uprising there last year when so many thousands of weapons were looted from army barracks.
But why do you think the world community or the international community has in a sense, not done for Kosovo what it's done for other republics?
Well, if there were to be changes of border, if there was to be an independent Republic of Kosovo, that would have a distinct impact on the neighbouring state of Macedonia, which has a very large Albanian minority, bordering on around 30%, roughly, of the population, who want and are ethnic. They have strong kinship ties with the people of Kosovo, and would dearly love to be united with the people of Kosovo. And this would really seriously destabilise the Macedonian state. In which case, Greece and Turkey, who have strong interests in seeing a maintenance of the status quo in Macedonia, would have to become involved. Needless to say, the Albanian government in Tirana would have to take a stance on whether there would be any unification with this new independent state of Kosovo, which would mean altering the borders of the new Albanian of the Albanian state, and this would bring into question what to do with the Albanian population of Montenegro. So you see, it's a very far-reaching problem. It affects the question about the independence of Kosovo affects every single neighbouring country.
At the Dayton Accords, which was signed back in 1995, it brought an end to the conflict in Bosnia, but it didn't bring an end to the fighting in Kosovo. And in a sense, Kosovo was really never discussed and no decision was made about its future at Dayton Accords. What impact did that have on the people of Kosovo?
The people of Kosovo themselves, the wider population, became increasingly frustrated, but still maintained faith in Ibrahim Rugova's ability to urge participate in sort of dialogue process that would achieve greater degrees of autonomy for the Albanians. But in the diaspora, in the large Kosovo diaspora of Albanians in Germany and Switzerland and Brussels, the mood was quite different. They became increasingly impatient. And it is really from this diaspora that we've seen the emergence of the what the Serbs call the terrorist activity. It was just a few months after Dayton in February 1996 that we saw the very first actions on behalf of the KLA, the Kosovo Liberation Army, when they attacked refugee camps of Krajina Serbs in northern Kosovo and announced to the BBC Albanian section here in London that they were an up-and-running guerrilla force dedicated to the liberation and independence of Kosovo, and calling themselves UÇK, the Kosovo Liberation Army.
British historian Miranda Vickers, her latest book is Between Serb and Albanian, A History of Kosovo. She'll be back with us to talk more about the conflict in Kosovo in the second half of the show. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen in for Terry Gross. We've been talking with Miranda Vickers about the fighting in Kosovo. More than 100,000 Kosovars have fled their villages due to the fighting between the Kosovo Liberation Army, the KLA, and the Yugoslav government forces. Vickers just returned from Kosovo, Albania, and Montenegro, where she was working as an Albanian analyst for the International Crisis Group, which was set up after the Dayton Peace Accord. She's also the author of Between Serb and Albanian, A History of Kosovo. I asked Vickers how the KLA recruit their soldiers.
They have no shortage of recruits from the diaspora, European diaspora, and also from the people themselves who are in Kosovo, the men and boys in the villages who want to defend their land. And some of these recruits have actually no wider ambitions or intentions other than protecting the very homes and fields and livestock and families that they have. It's those, the organizers of the KLA are... mainly from the diaspora, they have been getting quite large sums of money donated to them by in fundraising events during the last year. They hold regular meetings here in London and throughout Europe and in America, where vast sums of money are donated by wealthy Albanians, Kosovo Albanians, not Albanians from Albania. But as regards their tactics, they have more. Their weapon supply is somewhat erratic. They have more Kalashnikovs probably than they know what to do with, having bought up an awful lot of Albania's surplus Kalashnikov supply, which were looted, as I said earlier, from during the uprising in Albania last year. But what they need really is hard military hardware, much more sophisticated weaponry. They can't fight tanks and the military might of the Yugoslav army with Kalashnikovs, and here we have a problem. They are in effect going to be very useful as a guerrilla army, but not as a standing army. They don't need any more recruits. What the KLA really need is more money to buy more sophisticated weaponry, such as anti-aircraft guns, etc. And it's this phase of the struggle which I think they're going to have to aim for, because they have achieved singularly nothing really in the last 5 months of struggle. They have not managed to capture one single important town, albeit for a few hours or a day. And so they have to rethink their strategy.
Does the Kosovo Liberation Army have the support of the Albanians in Kosovo?
Yes. I mean, it's become now more of a people's army. And this is, as the more of this drags on, and the more paralysis we see and inaction on behalf of the international community on how to deal with this crisis, we're seeing this large swathe of territory being blitzed through by the Yugoslav army, people just up and moving, and have naturally they're going to support the only people they can see who can defend them, and that's not the passive Albanian politicians in Pristina under Ibrahim Rugova. These are the commanders with the weapons who although they're disunited, they are wherever they can be found. They present a form of sanctuary and safety to the people who are fleeing.
This crisis, this conflict in Kosovo, is this a greater threat to the Balkan regions and even beyond than the fighting the war in the former Yugoslavia?
Well, yes, because however awful and dreadful the fighting was in Bosnia, it could be contained. As I said previously, this cannot be contained if it's allowed to, if it spills into Macedonia. It's already affecting the ethnic balance in Montenegro and causing great disruption in northern Albania, where in particular the Kosovars do sympathise with the former ex-president Sali Berisha, who was overthrown in the revolution last year. The one key factor in all of this is that the Kosovars as a whole, that's the KLA leadership, the diaspora and people in Kosovo, have very little regard for the government in Tirana of Fatos Nano, who they see as a communist, although he represents a socialist party. They see that as the reformed communist party, and believe that the foreign policy of Tirana, of Albania, is being dictated by Athens and rather than for Albanian, the help of Kosovo Albanians. So there is a lot of distrust there. This conflict has got to be contained, otherwise the entire southern Balkan region is likely to erupt.
Let me go to the year 1991, and that was the year that Albanians in Kosovo declared independence, and it's the year that they also elected a president, Ibrahim Rugova. What was their vision for their country? Was it a a completely Albanian country, a country that then would create a kind of pan-Albanian state?
Yes, parallel state, which they set up, they didn't imagine would have to last for more than a year or so at the most, and while they were waiting for international recognition. But they believed also that the historic moment had come where they could unify all the Albanian peoples of the Balkans into what they call not a greater Albania, but what Albanians term as an ethnic Albania. That is, an Albania that includes all those of belonging to the ethnic Albanian nation who live in the former Yugoslavia and Albania, and a small region of northern Greece, which the Albanians called Ciamaria.
Was there room for Kosovo Serbs in this vision for a country?
Well, yes. In the manifesto, the constitution of the newly declared Republic of Kosovo, there was a clause giving rights to the minority Montenegrin and Serb minority who would remain in the province, along with the Turkish and Muslim minorities. These rights were going to be safeguarded under constitutional law. And as far as the Albanians were concerned, they would have achieved their self-determination, but with international guarantees of their sovereignty, but also international guarantees that the Slav minority would also be protected in this state.
Well, I want to talk some more, but first we have to take a short break. And our guest today is Miranda Vickers, and we're talking about Kosovo. She just returned from Kosovo. She's Albanian analyst for the International Crisis Group, and that was set up after the Dayton Accords. She's also a historian and a political analyst and the author of a history of Kosovo called Between Serb and Albanian. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Miranda Vickers, and we're talking about Kosovo. She's written a book on the history of Kosovo called Between Serb and Albanian. What role has Slobodan Milosevic played in this conflict in Kosovo, and what do you hold him responsible for?
Well, it's generally regarded that Milosevic used the Kosovo issue to bring himself credibility and power within in the last days of the old Yugoslavia. In 1989, he appeared on the anniversary of the Battle of Kosovo, 600th anniversary, where he gave a vitriolic speech using the famous phrase, "Never again will you Serbs," words to the effect that never again will Serbs be downtrodden and maltreated. He would be their protector, and the place where Serbs felt the most hard done by in the old Yugoslavia was in Kosovo, because of the status they were granted under Tito's 1974 constitution.
So, did he urge Serbs in Kosovo to rise up?
He not so much rise up, but he promised on their behalf to amend this constitution, in fact, repeal it completely, and bring Kosovo into the orbit of Serbia as a constituent of Serbia, not an autonomous province as it was under the 1974 constitution, thus giving Belgrade, rather than Pristina, control over the affairs of the inhabitants of Kosovo.
In talking about Kosovo, there are 2 million people that live there, 9 Albanians to 1 Serb. Have there been periods in the history of Kosovo when these groups have gotten along together, when they have been able to intermarry and in a sense, see each other as part of the same destiny?
Yes, I mean, ties have never been terribly close, but there was never the inter-ethnic strife we've seen this century, in previous centuries. The ethnic troubles we've seen between Serbs and Albanians have been largely exacerbated towards the end of the last century, from the Crimean War, 1856 onwards, by the great powers of the day, who were competing for supremacy in the region and using the various religious, socio-ethnic differences of the peoples of this part of the Ottoman Empire in order to achieve their own ambitions and goals. And because under Ottoman rule, the millet system did help divide Christian from Muslim, Albanian from Serb, etc., it was very easy for these great powers to exploit the differences and to exacerbate them. And we see this during the course of the Balkan Wars, the First World War, and the tensions that we've seen in the region ever since.
How different, though, are these cultures? Give us an example.
Well, one of the first most obvious differences is in the fertility level. Albanians often in the villages can have 12, 13 children. It's quite common. Whereas Slavs, be they Serbs or Montenegrins, very rarely have more than 2 to 3 children. Therefore, it gives the impression of, in Serbian villages and Serbian areas, of a much more orderly, tidier, neater environment. Whereas in the Albanian villages, there are just children everywhere, as far as you can see, children of all ages running up and down that. And that's, anyone who's brought up children knows that they do create a sort of aura of chaos if you get an awful lot of children running around. And this is one, it may sound superficial, but this is a distinction which Serbs, more than Albanians, actually bring up all the time. Because also in the Albanian villages, their houses are spotlessly, scrupulously clean. But there isn't, outside, there isn't such a sense of civic awareness, as you'll see much more litter and dirt in the streets of Albanian houses, whereas, as I've said, the people themselves and their homes are spotlessly clean. And Serbs are always complaining that the filth and dirt and squalor of Albanian villages means it's just impossible for them to live there. They just don't want to live in those kind of conditions.
We're talking about Kosovo today, and my guest is Miranda Vickers. She's the Albanian analyst for the International Crisis Group, which was set up after the Dayton Accords. She just returned from Kosovo, and she's the author of a book, A History of Kosovo, called Between Serb and Albanian. Well, I know that NATO has been considering the use of military strikes and haven't done so because they're not sure exactly how to direct those strikes. Would that move Milosevic, do you think, at all?
Well, it's hard to say. It really does depend on where the strikes are and what specific targets. But obviously the problem is this: in a legal sense, the Yugoslav army is defending its territorial integrity
because it's a country in a sense.
That's right. Yugoslavia is an independent country which is under threat from a secessionist terrorist organization. And that's the fact of it. That's that there's no country on earth that would let a terror just hand over territory to a terrorist group. The Albanians say they're not going to enter into negotiations unless Milosevic's troops withdraw from the areas that they hold. Well, that would effectively hand over that territory for good to the KLA. Well, the international community cannot expect Milosevic to acquiesce to that. Therefore, what pressure must be put on Milosevic is just to halt the destruction of the villages, to halt the harassment of those Albanians who are willing to return to their villages. We must get those people home before winter. There should be no reason why these villages need to be systematically razed to the ground, which at the moment they're not being done, but just a few houses being torched here and there. But this is enough to intimidate Albanians not to return.
You say it's imperative for the international community to pull itself together and to address the problem. What leverage, though, does the international community have? And based on what you have described for us, what alternatives do they have to bring some kind of at least peace and then some kind of resolution to the conflict?
Well, there's a reluctance, obviously, on behalf of not only the Americans, but the Europeans as well, to get bogged down yet further in the Balkans, because, as we know, the Dayton Accord isn't going too well and things could fall apart in Bosnia as soon as any international community forces left. And Macedonia's already been propped up by a significant presence of American troops and EU border monitors, etc. This is an extremely difficult problem. If the expense of all this has to be taken into account, I think It's been widely broadcast how expensive a deployment of troops in northern Albania alone and Macedonia along the border would be, because logistically the conditions are so bad that almost everything would have to be brought in from outside, and continuous backup would it would be phenomenally expensive. So these are the options the international community are having to weigh up, and you can understand their paralysis and hesitation and indecision. But on the other hand, unless, in my opinion, unless the Albanian border is reinforced by troops fairly fast, that country itself would be the first to be destabilised, and then followed by Macedonia. So I really feel that unless Milosevic can be told to stop, to halt the actual, to go, okay, continue his offensive against individual KLA guerrilla groups, but to leave the villages intact and to have international presence and international presence on the for the return in those villages, for when those villages do return, and to guarantee that their security and safety.
And based on what you know about the region and your observations there, are you optimistic, pessimistic?
I'm fairly pessimistic, really, because I think we're coming up to the elections in Macedonia pretty soon, and tensions there are literally at boiling point. The region is heavily armed. There are thousands of arms hidden away in Macedonia, just ready to be used. The Albanian minority there are a distinct, feel distinctly oppressed, there are some, not as bad as the situation in Kosovo, but there are serious human rights abuses in Macedonia, and it's the lid can't be kept on this boiling pot any longer. And that's I'm afraid we're not just talking about the problem in Kosovo, we're talking about the situation in Macedonia, which has like Kosovo been ignored and brushed under the carpet since everything was supposedly sorted out over Dayton, and I say Dayton itself is in a shaky position in Bosnia. So I think there needs to be an international conference on the future of the entire southern Balkan region, every single country, not to isolate Kosovo as a specific in this problem, or Macedonia as a specific. This is a regional problem, a serious regional problem for Europe.
Miranda Vickers just returned from Kosovo, Albania, and Montenegro, where she was working as an Albanian analyst for the International Crisis Group, which was set up after the Dayton Peace Accord. She's also the author of Between Serb and Albanian, A History of Kosovo. This is Fresh Air.